Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius, who has a special guest with him, which is his new puppy, Caspar. Herman, how are you, and how's the dog?
The dog is fine. I think the best way to describe me is distracted. I'm going to try and keep, focused on the things at hand, but I've got a puppy, so people are going to have to, just bear that in mind.
I think it's the best thing to be distracted by during a podcast. And of course, we have the fearless son of Benoni himself, Mr. Marius Root, whose camera is out and whose electricity is out, which is rather apt considering what our first story is going to be about. Marius, how are you?
Hi, I've managed to relocate to the metropolis of Johannesburg from East Rand for the podcast, so it should be fun. And let's hope Herman's dog doesn't do too much barking like my dogs tend to do sometimes.
Yes. Although I think it'll be even more adorable. Your dogs are cute, Marius, but they're nothing compared to the puppy. Anyway, let us get on to the first story today. And this is a pretty horrifying one. And it's been covered by numerous outlets, but there was a long piece by Ferial Hafaji on the Daily Maverick. And the headline is that two newlyweds were electrocuted in their home. The wife was going to take a shower. And she turned on the tap, and when she touched the tap, it began electrocuting her. Her new husband rushed in to try and help her, and he touched her as well and got electrocuted, and both of them were found dead in their shower. This was in Crosby in Johannesburg. The family of the couple said that they had complained numerous times to city power that they were being shocked by the electricity, by those taps. And yet nothing had been done about it. I've actually been shocked by taps before, so I know this is it's a pretty common occurrence. Community activists say that it's been happening for a long time in the area, and that they blame it on illegal connections in their area, which are constantly overloading the power or messing with it. And it seems that it's not simply in Crosby. We've also seen a story over the past couple of weeks that the areas served by the Hurst Hill Water Reservoir have been running dry, including some hospitals. And the situation got so bad that at Helen Joseph and Rahima Moosa hospitals, the Gift of the Givers charity organization went to drill a borehole because they literally couldn't give water to patients in the hospital. There's people dying from illegal connections all over southern Joburg. And a dear counselor who's a former colleague of mine, Nicole van Dijk, said that Johannesburg residents, this is quoting from her, are facing a real power crisis, which needs urgent short-term solutions to stabilize the grid and long-term plans to guarantee supply. At the weekend, there were 4,807 open calls about electricity cuts. So that's basically about 4,800 outages across Joburg. The city power depots say there's no money to replace the equipment. Parts are limited, and most of their repairs are being conducted with copper wire and insulation tape. Recently, a mini substation that had blown was replaced in a Joburg suburb, and within an hour, it had blown up again. So the situation has gotten really bad when it comes to infrastructure in Johannesburg. And that's, I think, what we need to talk about today. Maurice, so I know from when I was a Joburg city councillor, Joburg's infrastructure is not doing so well, but it looks like it's gotten worse over the last year in a significant way, especially during the pandemic. What's your thoughts on this, the causes, and what maybe should be done about it?
Well, I think the causes are obviously just not keeping the infrastructure maintained. And what should be done about it is that infrastructure should be maintained. All solutions are pretty simple. But it's obviously it takes political will. And I mean, a place like Johannesburg is a very big and complex place. I mean, I'm open to correction, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's got a bigger budget than a place like altogether than somewhere like the Northern Cape. And I know that in terms of politically speaking, its council is, I think, the second biggest legislature in South Africa after Parliament. Parliament obviously has 400 members, and I think Johannesburg has 270 councillors. So it actually makes it the second biggest political entity in the country. So it's obviously, and we know, I mean, Haram is not a Joburger, but I mean, he's from Pretoria, so he's obviously familiar with Joburg. But I mean, I'm also not a Joburger, but I'm from the East Rand, and you're a Joburger, so you're obviously intimately familiar with the place. But yeah, it's obviously, it's a big place, it's a complex place, and it's also an important place. If Joburg doesn't work, and Herman Mashaba also said this one a few times, I've agreed with him. Herman Mashaba said, if Johannesburg doesn't work, then South Africa doesn't work. And I think I agree with him. If Johannesburg fails, I mean, it's an important place. You know, there's lots of business gets done up here. And, you know, it's a city I think in some ways we can be proud of. You know, it's not great that there are things that are falling apart. And it's not just about water infrastructure and so on. There were also some concerns around some of the highway bridges around Joburg that they weren't being maintained properly. And there were some serious concerns recently that these could actually collapse if they aren't maintained. Because apparently they've been there's quite an innovative way that they were built to account for earth tremors from all the various mines that are still around Joburg and when they collapse. So there's actually apparently a very innovative way, but they also need to be maintained. So yeah, it's quite concerning. It's electricity is obviously not being maintained. The water infrastructure is not being maintained. The road infrastructure is not being maintained. And it's all kinds of things, you know, it's just, and as I say, I don't think it's hard. I mean, it'll take money to fix it, obviously, but it's going to take political will and won't be easy to do, but it needs to be done. But I mean, who knows if in the current environment if that will happen. So, but we do have local government elections coming up in October. And we mustn't forget that the ANC got below 50% in the last election in Joburg. But it remains to be seen if that will happen again. I think that probably will, but it'll be, yeah, it's going to, it depends if the DA or whoever will be able to, you know, build another coalition to keep the ANC out. I'm not that confident, but we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, so I know also from my time as a city councillor that there's serious problems with patronage, corruption, and just sort of gangsterism in city departments. There's lots of anecdotal evidence out there, which is kind of difficult to put into the bigger picture, but I'm going to try anyway. You know, I've heard stories of people in city power uniforms stealing electricity infrastructure while the power was out. There were lots of accusations while I was there of city power contractors, so not employees of the city power, but actually people who had been hired on basically breaking infrastructure so that they could be called out to fix it. There were even, you know, and there's also the problem with how these contracting companies get chosen. There were lots of accusations that they were basically through political connections and patronage and that kind of thing. A city power technician once told me that one of the permanent technicians raised a complaint about part-time contractors in city power. And he said that person was then fired because he had threatened some political person's business. I don't know if that's true, but that's at least what a lot of people seem to believe within the city administration. So it's a really big problem. Herman, I see you have your hands full, quite literally, but what's your take on this story? What needs to be done to fix this, and how did this happen?
I must say, it reminds me of the case from about a week ago, or the instance from about a week ago, where Clover closed the biggest cheese factory near Lichtenburg, if I remember correctly, and you know, with it gone 300 jobs in the area and 1.5 billion rand. It's the sad thing is, it's at local government level where political failures really start affecting the everyday lives of ordinary people. National legislation and those kind of national governance, that's really, I mean, it's important, of course, and it sets the tone. But if you want to make an immediate difference to the quality of life of South Africans, a really a powerful channel or tool to do that through, or mechanism to do that through, is municipal local government, because you deal with the service delivery, you deal with power and water and refuse removal and you know, the very basics of service delivery. So the fact that there are failures at this level just shows that South African lives are being ruined by bad governance. It's no longer just, you know, oh, we can roll our eyes at the people in parliament, you know, chanting inanities at some irrelevant pompous occasion. We are now at the point where even, you know, a flagship city like Joburg, flagship for not just South Africa, but the whole continent, becomes, as it were, something resembling a failed state. And that is absolutely shocking. And it is a terrible portent of the extent of the failure, because if there's one thing that politicians should be able to agree on, it is that we need to keep the lights on. We need not to kill our citizens through our incompetence. But even failures at that level are now starting to catch up with the ANC. And I hope that the October elections can really change that. I'm not going to speculate about it too much. We'll do enough of that. But it really is tragic that at the most fundamental level, where the state intersects with the ordinary daily lives of people, it's now come to this. In one of the flagship cities. It's been like this in many communities for years, but the fact that a place like Joburg is now falling to this creeping rot is very, very worrying.
I think the way I always see it is that the pattern of South Africa is something like this. In the mid-2000s, when the economy was growing and when crime was going down, all these good things were happening. The sort of wealth and development in South Africa's cities was kind of leaking out into the rural areas, and they were becoming more like the cities. Unfortunately, that trend seems to have reversed about 10 years ago as the ANC took that turn away from pro-growth policies, and the country, the dysfunction that's been present in many of South Africa's rural areas, the violence, the bad services, all these things has begun to leak into the cities. And you're seeing it now around the edges of the big metropolises. I think that in a couple of years, you know, we're going to really only, the only parts of South Africa that we can consider maybe, I guess, first world will be places like Sandton or some of the gated estates in the northern suburbs.
But Nick, it really it's like the case heading in. It's always quite jarring, the bubble that I sometimes find Sandton in on the occasions that we've been there, especially yes. When we look at when we were doing work for the IRR, consulting with these corporate entities. In there, you can really feel like it's almost a futuristic way. But within you know, not even a kilometer of that, you really see the deterioration. Bad roads, bad infrastructure, you know, just signs of a broken system.
Right. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that bubble is getting smaller. For a long time, you could live in South Africa and kind of avoid its problems if you had enough money. I think that's becoming more difficult nowadays. Maurice, any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I just want to point out that also, whether we like it or not, South Africa's cities are important. And South Africa's gone from about 30 years ago, half the population living in cities. Today, it's about 2/3. And all the research from around the world and in South Africa too shows you far more likely to be employed, far less likely to live in poverty if you live in a city. So, and that's also, I mean, this is a phenomenon around the world. It's not just South African phenomenon. People move to cities all over the place for better opportunities for themselves and for their children. And we've got to make sure that it's our cities where, you know, that our cities work, and when people do come out, because you're not going to be able to stop unless you become some totalitarian state where, you know, where you say you need a permit to move to a city like you get in China and Vietnam and whatever, which is obviously not acceptable, especially given our history too. You know, people are going to be moving to Joburg and Pretoria and Cape Town and Durban, whatever the case is. And we've got to make sure that the cities function properly and there's proper places for people to live and that there's an environment for businesses to function so that jobs are created and all these good things. And at the moment, and part of that is, you know, good physical infrastructure, you know, whether it's electrical or water or road or whatever the case is, you know, and that's the thing. Like, for South Africa to work, our cities have to function. I mean, that's, you know, that's the bottom line.
Very well said. All right, let us move on to our next story for today. And this is some good news for a change. We are seeing another medical aid or medical company coming into the fight against NHI. In a very nice way. So Bonitas Medical Fund's principal officer has warned against any suggestions to use medical aid reserves to help fund South Africa's upcoming NHI. The spokesperson for the company said that this wasn't sustainable. The proposals are fraught with illegalities, are in conflict with current regulation, and that the government has no right to take the savings of their members and use them to fund government healthcare. Herman, Your thoughts? This is good news. Another company joins the fight, at least in more unequivocal terms. Better late than never, I suppose.
Yes. I must say it is something quite pleasing to, I mean, Nick, you and I last year when we did a lot of work for the IRR's campaigning, we had a lot of engagements with corporate South Africa, and it sometimes got immensely frustrating to realize the extent to which they are simply not engaged. Behind closed doors, they will have all manner of opinions. But when it becomes an issue of, you know, official business and official positions, corporate South Africa has long been incredibly lily livered. So whenever a corporate comes out and says something that is actually worth listening to, it is indicative of, hopefully, or it can be indicative if used correctly by, you know, people like ourselves and our supporters, to show a shift in the balance of forces, and really illustrate that some policies just are not workable. And of course, the NHI here is the one that isn't workable. Now, what sort of flew past me, I think, in the last month, I'm going to investigate it a bit closer, but is the submission, or is the comment given by the Health Professionals Council of South Africa, what they said to Parliament, making the point that that medical aid schemes should be the funding mechanism for the NHI, and that amounts to about 92 billion rand, those reserves and savings and accounts and so on. And Bonita's Lee Kellerkoppen is now coming out and saying, you know, that is illegal, that can't work. It's a nationalization of large parts of the medical insurance sector. And we've been saying this for years at the Institute, saying that the NHI is nothing more or less than a nationalization of private healthcare. And for long, people would literally call it fear-mongering. They did the same with prescribed assets, but now it seems to be dawning on people. And Bonitas is important. It's the second biggest medical aid scheme in the country in terms of membership. And the fact that it is starting to oppose this nationalization push, this policy, is very encouraging. But I am very, very piqued. Ow. I'm very, very bitten, but I'm by my puppy, but I'm very, very interested to understand what exactly happened that the HP, that the healthcare professional, or the Health Professional Council of South Africa, took a position that its entire industry should be nationalized. I wonder if the HPCSA's members are aware of this, and if they are, I'm surprised they haven't spoken up more. But this is a good development. It goes on to point out the fact that if 92 billion rand of extra money isn't enough to fund a project, really, can a country like South Africa afford it? We don't know yet from the government how much this thing will cost. Some estimates put it to 200 billion, others to 400 or even 500 billion. But honestly, is this the state you want to have in charge of your healthcare, like they're in charge of your Eskom?
Right. I think the health insurance companies thought that whatever NHI was going to be, it was going to be cutting them in on the deal. The ANC decided to quote Darth Vader at them by saying, "I've altered the deal, pray I alter it no further." Because they seem to have woke up to the fact that there's no guarantee that they are going to be cut in on this deal when NHI is brought to bear. Marius, it really looks to me like the case for NHI has never been weaker. We've seen an enormous amount of corruption around COVID. We've seen an enormous amount of corruption in the department, in the health department specifically. I mean, even just today, the former health minister, or the on special leave health minister, whatever he is at the moment, Zweli Mkhize, said that the provincial departments were filled with corruption and irregular spending. We just talked about how some of the hospitals literally don't have water, and there don't seem to be any plans to provide the services for them, except when the private sector steps in.
Yeah, well,
can this policy survive under the weight of all these contradictions and irregularities?
Well, who knows? I mean, we might have seen some glimmers of hope last week with the news about SAA, but then also there seems to be something fishy going on there, but also with the announcement by the president that he's going to allow private entities to put 100 be able to make 100 megawatts of electricity, whatever it is. So maybe with NHI, what's going to happen is like what's been happening with this other stuff and lots. And why I mentioned this before in the show, what's happened before, that's part of the reason how apartheid ended, why India moved towards the free market, is where reality meets ideology and where reality wins. But we mustn't always think, remember, reality doesn't always win. Ask Venezuelans or ask Zimbabweans. You know, sometimes ideology beats the reality. So this could still happen. There's, you can make a moral case for NHI that everybody needs to have the same kind of level of medical coverage. And actually, if we do get NHI, everybody will have the same level of medical coverage unless you can leave the country, because the hospitals and so on. I mean, we see what happens at government hospitals. And I mean, they just, because there's hardly any kind of, there's no consequences for corruption or maladministration or what have you. And you mentioned what's been happening in some Gauteng hospitals. I was reading today, Gift of the Givers is actually building some boreholes for Gauteng hospitals to provide them with water. Also, what's happened in Charlotte Makeke, they haven't had, they had a fire there a little while ago and they've lost a significant amount of beds. And I mean, this doesn't help when we're now apparently in the third wave of COVID, especially in Gauteng. So, but also, I mean, I think we've also spoken about it on the show, and I don't want to, we don't want to say I told you so, but there was an article by Rob Rose from the end of last month, where he said, will South Africa's medical aid reserves be appropriated to fund the country's bankrupt plan for national health insurance? Until a week ago, you'd imagine this being a nuts conspiracy theory cooked up by a sect in the basement of the Institute of Race Relations. Then Professor Simon Nemutandani, and then he goes on to speak about the head of the Health Professionals Council, saying that actually we should give the 90 billion rand or whatever it is, that actually belongs to the state and should be used for NHI, which is, I mean, it's completely bonkers. That is basically people's private money, you know. It's like saying all this money sitting in people's bank accounts should be given to the state. it's quite nice to say I told you so, and you're a bit vindicated. So,
But I must say, Marius, that not a shred of some humility. In people, saying, oh, cooked up in the basement of the IRR. Even in his slight mea culpa, he manages to not show that, proper policy and ideological analysis matters and can give you clues other people simply don't have.
Well, you're exactly. Wrong that we don't have a basement.
We're a virtual organization now. So. It's...
anyway,
it just seems to me I don't see how NHI can work, and I also don't see, taxes, personal income tax will have to be increased by at least between 10% and 20% to fund this thing, and I don't see how you're going to be able to increase personal income tax by 10% or 20% even. We already see there's I think people are already getting hutful, and I don't think most South Africans aren't anti-tax libertarians, but I think most South Africans are people who don't want their taxes to go to, waste.
They will be soon.
Exactly.
They will be soon.
I think that's the thing. It'll be crazy to see how many libertarians probably live in a failed state.
Anyway. All right. So it's good that we're seeing this more pushback from the industry. And obviously, we will continue our efforts to fight back against national health insurance, because it will cause a lot of suffering for a lot of people. But let us move on to a very weird story. So I think we may have mentioned it briefly at the beginning of the show, but there was a story doing the rounds a couple of days ago that a woman had given birth to 10 babies in one go. She was from Tembisa, and apparently she had been in a Pretoria or Centurion hospital and had given birth to these 10 babies, which would have been a world record for the most number of children born alive in one go. This was reported originally by the Pretoria News. Things got a bit weird after that, though. Some government departments said that they didn't know who the woman was. Hospitals around Pretoria and Centurion said that they had no record of 10 babies being born, which would, you'd expect the doctors that literally broke a world record to be coming on record. There was a lot of confusion about this. Then more details emerged. Apparently, the father of the children hadn't seen the children or the mother, and claimed that she was actually not his wife, that this was a love affair. Then there were more details which emerged where the family said, no, no, she was in hospital. The babies were in hospital. No picture was produced of them. The parents said that they were all fighting for their lives and that they didn't want to talk about it for cultural reasons. Iqbal Survey, the owner of Independent Media and well-known ally of the Ace Magashule Zuma faction of the ANC, reportedly also went out and announced that he was going to give R1 million to this family as a donation to help support them and their children. So it's very strange, but it looks a lot like the whole thing is beginning to fall apart. Originally, it was reported that Mediclinic was the hospital company that had where the mother had given birth. But Mediclinic says they have no record of such a birth taking place. So it looks a lot like this whole story might have been a bit of fake news. But it is very strange. What's the angle here? How is Iqbal Survey involved? And Marius, what should we take away from this episode of weird fake news?
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. And I mean, just weird that there's been, as you say, no doctors come forward. And I saw Clement Mangantela, he was on Twitter this morning saying, I can't remember which hospital it was, but he said the CEO of the hospital came forward and said that the babies had been born there. But then the spokesperson for the hospital phoned in and said, no, there definitely weren't 10 babies born here. So there's something very weird going on. And it does seem, I mean, Piet van Paerdy is also a bit of a strange guy. He's pushed some weird, strange conspiracy theories. And, you know,
so Piet van Paerdy was the reporter.
And he's also he's the editor of Pretoria News as well. And he's pushed some of these weird conspiracy theories that, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa is controlled by the whites and, you know, blah, 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 all the kind of, you know, usual nonsense. But, and also, I mean, Iqbal Survey, like, I mean, is this some kind of weird fundraising thing, maybe, where people give money for these alleged 10 babies and then...
Right, that's been another aspect of this, is that the family has been receiving large numbers of donations from people who were excited by the news. But then I believe the alleged father of the children went out to say that he hadn't seen the children, people must stop giving money to the family.
Exactly. And also, I mean, cool if they want some privacy or whatever, that's fine. But you'd think there'd at least be one photo, one official photo of the 10 babies and the mother, you know, to go out and just say, look, here are the 10 babies. And as you said, there'd be interviews with the doctors because, you know, it's a world record thing, you know. South Africans, I mean, you know, that's just it would be something that, you know, like we would want to talk about and so on. But just the fact that, and also today with things like cell phones, which everybody has, and no one photo has come out of these babies, you know, no one acquaintance or nurse or whatever has taken a photo of these next 10 babies, seems to me very strange. And it's, you know, it just also shows you how credulous South Africans are. And also, I mean, yeah, a lot of people just accepted this at face value. But yeah, I think we need to be very careful. And it shows again how far the independent group of newspapers has fallen. You know, they were a great group of newspapers that did a lot, you know, to raise awareness of the injustice of apartheid and so on. And then they were kind of cannibalized. They were sold to Irish group of newspapers. Lots of the assets were cannibalized and stripped and so on. And then they were sold to Iqbal Survey with some very fishy dealings. And we all know, I mean, I don't want to get sued, so I don't speak much about Iqbal Survey, but he's a bit of a, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Interesting character in the best use of the term. But yeah, so I mean, just shows you, and I mean, apparently Pretoria News sells 2,000 copies a day. So it's hardly, you know, shows you how far it's fallen from its heyday. And who knows, maybe this is also just an attempt to get the circulation of the thing up. But yeah, it's all very strange, and I think we all need to be very skeptical of this.
I think it also speaks as to the quality of reporting in South Africa, how, never mind political bias and stuff, which is a big problem in South African media, but just the quality of facts, relaying facts, has gotten really bad. Herman, your thoughts in brief on this before we wrap up?
Yeah, no, that was the point you just made was exactly the point I would I wanted to make. The fact that reporting the news is now something that itself needs to be investigated for accuracy. I mean, perhaps it's just a very clever way to give investigative journalists some jobs.
The thing is, there's so much work currently for investigative journalists because there's so many corruption scandals you can go and poke your head into. But anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. Someone asked in the comments, what podcast platforms are we on? We're on Spotify. We're on iTunes. We're on Google Play or Google Podcasts, I think it's called. So you can find us on all of those. Also, There will be no show tomorrow because, of course, it is Youth Day, a public holiday. So we hope you all enjoy whatever you are up to tomorrow. And we shall see you again on Thursday for another episode of the Daily Friend Show. Thank you very much, everyone, and have a good day.